Good evening, everyone. My name is Don Gates, an alcoholic. I commended the leader here for having a break, despite the fact it would lead to a certain amount of turmoil and consternation, because it's almost impossible to be spiritually receptive with a full bladder. And I enjoyed and was delighted by Vano's remarks there. I do not come to dispute what she has said. I do but come to fulfill. That was a magnificent talk. And there are, you know, someone said here earlier about there being no coincidences. I guess not, but on the other hand, it's strange. I can remember one time having a discussion down in the southern part of the country with someone, and he, you know, one of the spiritual ones, and he said, "God never makes a mistake." And I said, "How do you explain Lubbock, Texas?" And I'm introduced as being, of course, from Los Angeles and so on, but basically I'm a country boy trying to pass. And I enjoyed the Boozville Bombers. I thought Leo was about the cleverest MC I've seen in a long time. You know, we in California had such illustrious MCs as Jack Bailey, old Queen for a Day fellow, and a lot of the very big names out there, Walter O'Keefe, that you may remember from television, and I can use their full names now because they passed on to the sober reward, and Pat B, who's there now, kind of a country boy. But that was very good. The only thing that I would have improved was the joke you tried to make about lawyers and judges. You know, because there are so many things you can say about that profession that you really don't have to scrape around. Somebody right here in the podium, you know, was mentioning to me that they had so many lawyers, and I told them, you know, that's true. California has more lawyers than any other state or country in the world. On the other hand, New Jersey has the most toxic waste dumps. You know why that is? New Jersey had the first choice. No, but I really enjoyed it. We had just about every hue on the spectrum of the theatrical world. We had the young lady I'm very bad with the name, Vano or Vano or something, but we had a lady who got up and told vile stories. And, you know, and she really has a filthy mind, and I admire that in a woman. And then we had an intellectual performer, the fellow who did the Terry, I guess it was, who did the football shtick. If you recall, he ended saying that he had maintained a little bit of sobriety with the Latin motto, illegitimus non carborundum. The last time I had seen that particular message, it was on a little plaque, a little monument. This This sort of thing saves me from having to tell you what I used to be like. But this, you know, obviously, though a slight interruption to an otherwise. but that is literally true. That is what many of us, and almost all of us, were like when we were drinking. You don't give a good goddamn about anybody. You just say, see me, look at me, notice me. I hear people say, we're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people trying to get well. You can say that if that's how you like to classify yourself. I'm not either one of them. I'm an immature person trying to grow up. I began to drink when I was 15 years old, and adolescence is a form of insanity. When the testosterone rushes on, all you care about is yourself. If you want to know what we are like, look at what you were like when you started drinking. For most of us, we started in our adolescence. And alcohol is a great preservative. Or any of the other better living through chemistry that's available today. You break the pain-pleasure teaching cycle. You stop maturing the moment you begin to take any form of chemical, because we learn the same way we train animals, the same way that we train children, through the pain-pleasure principle, same way we train old men. When I do wrong and you punish me, I see the point. When I do well and you reward me, I see the point. But the moment you take chemicals, you break that learning cycle. You take a little shot of that hoo-wee, and you get euphoria that you didn't earn. This gives you a wrong impression of what life is like. And when you do something terrible, something that you should feel shame and remorse and hatred of self for, you take some more of that hoo-wee, and you don't pay the price. It is entirely possible to repeat the same damn stupid behavior indefinitely as long as you continue to drink or take the other chemicals. There's nothing very mysterious about our disorder in that sense. If you want to see selfishness, look in a crib. Look at a little baby. Pure selfishness. He doesn't give a goddamn if it's convenient to change his diaper to feed him. Now you have to thwart that little monster in order to teach him to live among other people. Now, naturally, that is a painful process. It is hard to learn. The only thing harder than growing up is not growing up. I was thinking of that, the patience that Leo and the rest of the people in the bombers had with those two orphans last night. I don't know if any of you were there, but there are two orphan girls up in front who are running around waving their arms. Well, they were orphans, weren't they? I can't believe a parent would allow a child to behave like that. Now, I'm not saying that when you start drinking or taking the other chemicals that you stop aging. I'm talking about stopping maturing. You'll grow gray in the temples, wrinkle around the face, be educated beyond your intelligence, perhaps, but you'll remain that damn child. And that's what I found I was when I got here. Really, it was simple as that. I didn't have any grave emotional disorders. We're quoting the doctor here. Doctor says the only thing that distinguishes the alcoholic from the non-alcoholic is the phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. We have psychotics on our programs, sociopaths, psychopathic inferiors, neurotics in every hue on the emotional spectrum, and then people who are normal, healthy, well-adjusted, lovable people, normal in every respect except the effect alcohol has on. That's what the book says. I've never met any of them. You know, but having sobered up in Los Angeles, you wouldn't be apt to. I tend to suspect they're congregated and coagulated around Akron and Cleveland, you know, where the early meetings were. But no, I enjoyed that show there. I liked... the only thing that really kind of disappointed me, I guess, was... What was it? Sheer Misery and the Padre and then the dance team. You liked that. I looked for it so much, and it was just a typical West Hollywood participation meeting, as near as I could tell. And the act put on by this gentleman here, who oddly enough is called Tiny. You know, he was telling me before the meeting, he asked if I was nervous in going to have to speak. And I said, no. Why should I be nervous? I mean, a room full of people, lucky to have an institution, and I'm supposed to be worried about what they think. And, I didn't say it to him, but anybody could get up and do what he did should never worry about being nervous in public. I would have had to been bombed out of my gourd to do that. But I did explain to him seriously how actually I learned to overcome nervousness. It wasn't that I wasn't nervous when I arrived. I was, not because I didn't know I could speak, that was what I did for a living, you know, but nonetheless, whenever I had to give in a public address or appear in a courtroom, my hands would just tremble, like a butterfly on a mating flight if I picked up a piece of paper. You know, it was a true handicap for a trial lawyer. You know, you approach the witness stand, perhaps this will refresh your memory. And so we were driving another fellow and I down to speak at a prison, and I was telling him about this condition and how I'd always had it and how it occurred in AA whenever I had to speak. Now, I didn't want an answer to my problem. I don't really know that any newcomer is really looking for answers. That's what I wanted, was him to say, "Stout fellow, brave of you to carry on with such a fearsome malady." Because when I ended my talk, this was my red badge of courage, you see, and when I ended it, I kind of gave a little sigh, wiped the corner of my eye to cleanse the tear, and said, "I guess it's just insecurity." Now, this guy just remained silent, totally mute, for an infinite length of time. You know, probably a full minute, which that's a long time when you're waiting for a compliment. And then he said, "Yes, I guess you could call it insecurity if you cared to, but I would suggest to you that if you will turn that coin over, on the other side, you're going to find your big fat ego." He said, "We're driving down here to talk to a bunch of men who are caged like animals because they have a problem for which you think you may have found some sort of solution. Now, I want you to know this. If you say one word, it helps one man, you've given a good AA talk. If you don't say that word, but you convince all of them what a glittering, jewel-tongued orator you are, you've utterly failed. The reason you're nervous, Don, is you don't give a damn about them. You're not concerned with helping them. You're concerned with what they're going to think of you. You're playing for their approval. You don't care about them. You get nervous talking to a newcomer in your front room?" Ooh. I take this just like I take all constructive criticism, like a knife right in the back. You know, I pulled out the blade, tried to find some chink in his armor I could insert it into him, and I couldn't, so I returned it to my spine and rotated like a pig on a rotisserie for a little while. And I thought, you know, by God, he's right. That's why I'm nervous. I'm thinking about their opinion of me. I don't care about them. I've always been able to rise above the suffering of others. So I got to that jail meeting that night, and before I went up to speak, I said a little silent prayer to that which I didn't think was listening, and said, for once, if it's okay, I would like to be concerned only with what I can say to help somebody and not of what they're going to think of me. And for the first time in my entire life, my hand was steady as a rock throughout the talk. I was so impressed the next time I went into a courtroom, I said, instead of me being concerned with what the bailiff, the spectators, the jury think of, the judge thinks of me as an individual, let me say the best that I can, honestly, for my client, and let them all do their own job. Steady as a rock throughout the trial. It has never returned to me, except on a few occasions when I wanted to impress people. Once or twice in my profession, I've had occasion to address a prominent group, and I was concerned about what they would think of me, and it started in again. And I had to back away from it. I've enjoyed this convention. I really have. And that's unusual for me. I don't say thanks the committee at most of them because I don't like conventions. I can use up a whole month's sociability on one weekend at a convention. You know, I have to be grouchy for 3 weeks to average out sometimes. And the committee was kind enough to let me arrive a day early. I made a mistake. I didn't really realize how short a flight it would be up here, and I'd done the shtick back in Atlanta and cross country, and, you know, sitting in an airplane with your knees in your face and all weekend, and then you get there and you're off the time schedule and you can't sleep, and then they introduce you to 10,000 people, and then you get on and give a pitch and you can't sleep after that, and then you get up early in the morning and fly all the way back to, you know, I was so upset and tired one Monday morning, I almost reversed a conviction. And so I asked the committee if they would put me up here and a day early, and I did. And they've left me alone, and that's what I like. I like to get out and do things. That has to do with outside activities. And I've truly enjoyed your countryside. I used to do a shtick. By the way, I'm going to try to stay away from some of the broader gags that and the committee said, we love the golden oldies, tell your old. Yeah, I'm so tired of those. There's tapes that they sell out here. I noticed, by God, at least they do have me in the modern speakers instead of those from the past. And on humorous speakers and so on. That's strange. You get up and tell a story that would tear tears from the heart of a stone, and they list you among the humorous speakers. But I truly have enjoyed getting out and doing things on the outside. And I used to do a shtick about how AA is not a program of elimination, it's a program of substitution. If you were to take away from the drinking person all that booze does for them, you would create a vacuum. Nature abhorring a vacuum, if you didn't substitute, they'd be out drunk again. And so I tried to one day sit down and figure out, why do we drink? What leads anyone to drink? Why would anybody drink something so damn vile that you can scarcely swallow it unless you've cut it to the point it isn't worth drinking? I'm talking about raw whiskey now. Occasionally you hear a newcomer, even a thoughtless old timer, say, I enjoyed the taste of a good bourbon. You know, he hasn't reflected on that. Remember what that was like, that goddamn raw searing thing come down and clear your larynx all the way down? You know, hit the bottom of the nauseating splash, particularly when you're drinking sideways in the car so a cop couldn't see it. You know, you know, just make you shudder, you shake, you know, like a man leaving a urinal, you know, that involuntary twitch. Because everything in you wants to throw it back up again, because it's poisonous. I mean, that's where we get the word intoxicated. It comes from the word toxic. Toxic substances are poisonous, and you drink enough of a toxic substance and you become intoxicated. So your body wants to throw it back up. But if you can just keep it down, boy, then you'll get the dry heaves and diarrhea. Now, why would anybody do that, alcoholic or non-alcoholic? Because the best definition I've heard of an alcoholic, other than the one given in our book, was in American Medical Journal many, many years ago, and they said an alcoholic is a person who drinks to escape the problems created by drinking. If you had the trouble I did when I drank, you'd have drunk too. So why do we do it? Do we do it for some kind of weird, abnormal reason? Near as I can see, we don't. Why does the non-alcoholic drink? Because he finds, when he comes into a social gathering, whether it's a large party or even an intimate little get-together with friends, there's always that awkwardness in the beginning, that sort of stilted conversation. And so the hostess comes out with the libations, passes the glasses around. Or today, maybe the hand-rolled cigarettes, or, you know, or whatever it is that they're into. But they hand it around. And then they change. It works. Next time you're sober, look at a group of, they don't have to be alcoholics, look at the non-alcoholics. They take two or three drinks, and they change. I'm not saying they're improved, but they change. The wheels of social intercourse now flow. Before, you were worried, were they going to like me? Were they going to see what a fine, sterling chap hides behind his humble facade? And then had people over there, I'm not so sure, like, you take a couple of drinks and... Well, of course they'll like me, and you, pretty girl. And this has nothing to do with alcoholism. This is why non-alcoholics drink. Mr. Milky Toast at the party... Christmas party, gets drunk, gooses the secretary. He's not an alcoholic. He's just, alcohol's doing what he wants it to do. Now, I was shy. I was uncertain people were going to like me. Not an alcoholic trait, it's a human trait. And so I would take a couple of drinks, same as they did, in order to be able to socialize. The only thing is, I'm an alcoholic. Once I take a couple of drinks, then the drinks take a couple of drinks. And then the drinks take me. I don't know why. I'm out in the kitchen. I'll mix the drinks. You young folks dance. Hop, pop, pop, pop. Spend the balance of the evening sitting on the couch like a zombie, you know. He's a nice man, but don't touch him. He topples, you know. Non-alcoholics also drink because it's the oldest known form of psychiatry we ever had. It relieves tension. You come home at the end of the day and you're tense. You're anxious. In Los Angeles, in Salt Lake, I'm sure, the freeways are crowded. There isn't enough respect. There isn't enough honor. There isn't enough money. There isn't enough recognition. There isn't enough of anything. And we're all reasonable. All we want is more than there is. And so you come home and you're frustrated. Frustration produces an electric charge in the cells of the body. You stop a little amoeba in his progress and he sparks electrically. You frustrate us, and by God, we spark. So we come home, had nothing to do with alcoholism. We come home, and everybody says, like a couple of drinks, you know, kind of relax before dinner. And the non-alcoholic, he does it. He takes one or two and they work. He relaxes. He thinks, I made too big a deal out of that thing today. Just as well we're out of that field. Glad it fell through, really, come to think about it. I'll probably work on this other one. And I shouldn't have snapped at old Fred. With the trouble he's having at home, God, no wonder he gets edgy. I'm going to apologize. We can all talk. Hey, Flo, is the roast ready? I mean, that's the way the non-alcoholic is. He takes a couple of drinks, they work, and he doesn't drink anymore. I used to come home very tense. at the height of my drinking, I was a chief trial deputy in a DA's office. And I used to, that was all I did, you know, and going to prosecute. And I was the white knight. The only trouble is, in the courtroom, the only difference between the white knight and the black knight is that he's representing the other guy and I'm representing my guy. And it was true in private practice. I never lasted in the DA's office. I couldn't make it for more than 8 or 9 months. I think I never prosecuted somebody for something I hadn't done. And it was my, I got the hell out. I mean, it's much better on the defense. You know, there you can wave your arms, open your fly, anything to obfuscate the issue. But I would be frustrated because the bad guys had just as many rights as I did. That's unfair in the beginning when you represent righteousness. But maybe finally I would get his client on the stand about to rip the truth from his perjurous lips through my scalpel like an adroit cross-examination when he would object. Had no damned reason to object. Just a chance to throw, you know, just an opportunity to throw me off my train of thought, to give that prevaricator a chance to think of new falsehoods to foist on the court. It's fight or flight time now. Because that's what it is. It's a fight. We used to pay champions to bludgeon each other with clubs. Now we pay them to lash each other at their lips. Yeah, but it's still a fight in there. The only thing I ever liked about it was walking into the courtroom tall and strong in front of my frightened client, just like Perry Mason, by God. But once the fight started, it was terrible. He's objecting. No reason. You know, what do you want to do? The adrenaline's flowing. It's fight or flight time now. That's what mankind has done for eons. You want to turn and say, shut your mouth, that stupid objection, I'll punch you out. Or you want to say, if learned counsel had but read evidence code section 352, he would know that, or you want to run weeping from the courtroom. I try to bring a little light in here, try to remove that chanker from the white angel of the law. So most of the time, as I say, you don't do either. You just stand there. If learned counsel had but read evidence code 352, he had no objection lies. However, Your Honor, perhaps might be an appropriate time to declare the morning recess. I think I'm going to puke. Because I tried both the other methods, you know, and then the bailiffs begin to talk, you know, don't object to that guy, crazy. So I used to come home, and I would take a couple of drinks to relax. Same as a non-alcoholic. I wasn't trying to escape from reality, take a flight from reality. I wanted to take a couple of drinks to relax. The only thing is, I'm an alcoholic. I would take a couple of drinks, and then the drinks would take a couple of drinks. And pretty soon, the drinks would take me. Pretty soon, my children would be going to bed, you know, walking over my prostate body, you know. Don't get up, Daddy. Don't even try. Now, I wasn't attempting to be a wretched example of fatherhood. I'm doing the very best I could, and I used to get up off that bed of pain and go right back in there the next day. The alcoholics carry a tremendous load. You know, sometimes we talk about how wasteful we were and how we didn't try, you know, how we're... Most of us tried like hell to be good parents, good citizens, carrying a killing disease. And no one ever told me that there was anything wrong with my drinking. What they told me was, Don, we don't want to be WCTU, blue nose. We don't suggest you quit drinking. We suggest you take one or two and then stop like we do. That's like saying, Don, well, all we ask is that you take a box of X-Lax and then don't go to the toilet. I know I didn't drink for any different reason than the non-alcoholic. Another thing non-alcoholics drink for is there is something spiritual in liquor. Any primitive religion had wine in it. Today they just take a sip maybe, but in the old days they really put it on. Peyote buttons, hashish, fermented goat's milk. You name it, every spiritual movement had some kind of a thing that chemically affected you and brought the people closer together. I remember when the LSD craze was on some 20 or 30 years ago, I read an article in one of the magazines. The kid said, I took my fifth LSD trip today. I saw God, but otherwise it was nothing. And I could identify with that because I remember riding in a bus up this valley in California during the war, and I was seated in this bus by the window, balanced on the razor's edge of intoxication, and I looked out at this little city we were passing through, and I accepted it. I found it fair, and I embraced it and blessed it. I used to bless cities then, and I looked at the people in the street. Yea, verily, they too were the salt of the earth. I found that was Modesto. Now, anyone who would give up something that would do that for Modesto, California, without a life and death struggle is mentally ill. So, as far as I know, we didn't drink for any different reason than anybody else. Some of us, maybe some others did, I don't know. But the reason I brought that up, or why it flashed through, is I was trying to explain why I happen to have a somewhat disheveled mouth here. I love to get outdoors, as I mentioned, and I took a hike up City Creek to its very end, where you get up onto a ridge where you can look down over three counties or something. And since the rain, apparently a tree had fallen down, and I ducked under a branch, under a limb, and a branch I couldn't see caught me right in the mouth and split my lip pretty good. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? AA substitutes, it doesn't eliminate. In the old days, I used to have to get drunk and get into a fight in order to have a busted lip. You know, and, no, I've liked everything about this convention. I like that, or the first, the speaker last night, he mentioned that he had cancer and heard me talk, both in the same sentence. I don't know about that, but earlier they had had a thing that they called sex in sobriety, or sobriety in sex, or whatever it was. And they had about half a dozen people get up and take their fifth step. And, you know, I thought, good God, where did they find these people? You know, the men, it got almost a kind of a bragging contest there. I can't believe that was, some of them were serious, you know. They were all women abusers and, you know, and takers and so on. Sitting by an Al-Anon, she had an orgasm just listening, you know. You know, I was one of the committee people. They took me out to dinner, and one of the committee people actually asked me, would I like to be on that panel, you know, that sex and sobriety panel or something. And two of the people there, if you may remember them, Emma and Donnie, I think it was, Emma said, I heard her say to her husband, what would he do, that old goat? You know, a brisk hike and a love affair would kill him. Now, that's not true. I hike along pretty good, ask my wife. In fact, today I took a hike up to your Mount Raymond up here. It's 10,200 feet or something like that. And I do this because I smoke too long and I ruin my lungs, which is, people have been kind of kind about it. I'm not recommending it for you social smokers, but I turn, you know, even though I come from the backwoods of Oregon, I turned myself into a living smoke shed, and I made lung jerky. So I've had to do something to try to restore what little I had left. You can't really heal your lungs because that hot smoke sears them and scar tissue never heals, but you've got a pretty good sized thing. So they got me into doing things. And this is why You know, today I was hiking out there, and that's a high climb. But God, it's gorgeous this time of year in your country. You walk along, and at one place it was very closed in, and you would go through an actual sea of scarlet all around you. And then you would hit an ocean of gold. And then you'd be back in the evergreens with the waves of green breaking over you. And I get up on the top and I can see Salt Lake, Great Salt Lake out here, and all of your city and the mountains on the other side, and there's snow on some of the peaks. It doesn't say God could and would if caught. It says God could and would if sought. And when I get up there, I can't tell you that I have any greater theological insights, or as I walk through those brilliant colors, it doesn't give me any greater belief in any dogma, but I don't care to be alive, to live, to exist, to see such beauty. Isn't that enough? Isn't it enough to know that when it's good going out, it's good coming back? You know, it's astonishing. See, to me, this is a spiritual bit. I'm too rapid a personality to have ever been able to meditate in the quiet as some people can. By the way, I don't want to get into analysis of things I don't understand, but one of the theories as to why alcoholics are the way they are is that we seem to be biologically different in that we don't produce endorphins like other people, and therefore we see everything in technicolor and we're crushing it. When I first sobered up, I didn't know it at the time, but I got into what are thrill sports. Because you do something that is anything, by the way, which is good, either socially or as a personal thing, it produces endorphins. Your body's the greatest chemistry set you've ever going. Drugs and alcohol, by the way, isn't what makes you feel good. It's that fits into the synapses of your brain and gives you that feeling. But your body will do that. When you get onto a roller coaster and you get done, you know, why in the hell would somebody pay to be frightened? It's because when you're done, the endorphins kick in. That's a form of endogenous morphine. And you feel wee. And because in the time when we were more primitive, if you had to go out and face the tigers out there, you had to have some kind of a damned reward. You know, otherwise you'd stay in a cave. You know, go out there, boy. And I used to give a talk in which I talked about the wild and the bully and things I've done sober. You know, about the fact that I took free fall parachute jumping just before I became my grandfather, how I got through the male menopause racing motorcycles in the desert with Steve McQueen, you know, and went scuba diving. You know, I was supposed to study, put on flippers. Hell, I haven't time for that. You know, hum a couple of bars. Beside, when I came around, they told me everything you need to know is in the big book anyhow. So I got in, dove down in Seaweed City, put the stuff on, jumped in off Catalina Island, ran out of air down there. You know, it was so beautiful. But also, if you do things that are physical, they're good for you. And because I was so shattered, they told me to get into running. Well, that's the most despicable form of locomotion one could imagine. All of my life I've seen runners, usually gnarled old men with gnarled knobby knees, you know, with sweatbands grunting along the side of highways. You know, I think, oh God, that pathetic souls, that it should come to that. See, a fanatic is anybody who's doing something a week before I start. Now I'm one of them. They got me out there. I couldn't go half a block when I started. But I kept it up. I got up to 2 miles, you know, and I was leaving the house one morning, caught myself skipping. You know, I thought, Jesus, God, I hope the neighbors didn't see that. You know, I didn't skip as a boy. I've been called Mr. Gates since I was 13. My intimates call me sir even today. You know, and I thought, what's wrong with you? Well, what was wrong was I had been out and taken a trudging run. I've given new meaning to the word trudge, by the way. I may call myself a runner, but you would have to be charitable to describe me that way. If you heard the expression, justice is slow, that comes from someone who saw me run, I think. But when you do something like that, it is good for the body. And therefore, your body kicks in these endorphins. And the reason I was skipping was I was high. Well, now, no one had ever told me this about running. They had told me it was good for me, which I construed as a threat. You'll do this, you know what's good for you. In the Army, they made you run double times of the pack if you goofed off. In sports, they made you run laps if you didn't pay attention. I thought, assumed it was a form of pain. Nobody had said to me, Don, it's not only good for you, it'll make you feel good. They don't know how to communicate with me. Well, hell, if 2 miles will make you feel good, see, moderation is a rumor to me, and if 2 miles will make you feel good, how about 4, 8, 16? I mean, within a year, I was up to half marathons. Had bursitis in the hip, my back gave out, stress fractures in both feet. I didn't have a moment free from pain after I got healthy. But the body heals, it gets well. You know, and I haven't been injured in a long time now. On my 60th birthday, the very day of my 60th birthday a few years back, the first major LA marathon was run, and they had a flyer out that said, if you're 60 or over, you get a $5 discount. Now, if you can't see the hand of God or not, I don't know what it would take if you grew up during the 30s. Well, I signed up, put myself through 4 hours of hell, and ran 26 miles. Now, the significance of this is that when it comes to willpower, alcoholics are not lacking. You know, sometimes the non-alcoholic will say of us, you folks are lacking in willpower. Do you know why they say that? They think we want to stay sober. If they had any idea what our true goal was, they would stand in awe of our dedication and perseverance. What do they have they will pursue to the gates of insanity or death, huh? Nothing, candy asses. Present company excluded. No, I know there are non-Al-Anons here, and I'm not making fun of you. You're not at fault. You seem to have been born that way. And there's nothing you can do about it. Speaking of Al-Anons, I don't know if I finished this story about the intellectual gentleman with the illegitimate known carborundum. You know, the last time I was going to mention, the last time I'd seen that was a little monument that President Reagan, at that time he was still governor of the state of California, and he had appointed Bill Clark to the same court that I now sit on, and he had given it to him. I mean, it's its translation is, don't let the bastards grind you down. And I don't know why that reminded me of Al-Anon. I make fun of it. I really admire Al-Anon tremendously. It is an astonishing organization, and I particularly love their talks, because most of the time they don't have to tell what they used to be like drinking, you know, and waste the time with that nonsense. And I've experienced release with love. It's indistinguishable from rejection. You know, boom! But it'll save your life. It'll absolutely save your life. Today, as I indicated, I see nothing mysterious about alcoholism. When I got here, I thought it was some strange and mysterious malady for which science had neither cure nor adequate name or identifying means. And now it seems like the simplest disorder ever to have afflicted mankind, the most easily recognizable, identifiable, and treatable. You know, the very name gives you such a marked clue as to what the problem is. If you weren't handicapped with a degree in psychology and someone said, what do you think causes alcoholism? I warrant you'd come up with the correct guess instantly. Alcohol? You know, right? And some quarters, they don't still recognize that. They think it's caused by bowel training. Failure to close an Oedipus triangle. The decline of petty bourgeois capitalism. I mean, your parents' fault. There's a whole group now talking about their parents, which is an astonishing thing. But alcoholism caused by alcohol. Alcohol had never been invented. You wouldn't have one alcoholic classified as such in the face of the earth. You just have one more of the 1 in 10 out there who is strange, living oddly, unless he happened to find some kind of a spiritual program, because the program we have is not indistinguishable from the others. I'm an absolute fanatic, of course, about our program. You don't have to be, perhaps, but I stood up during the 25 to 30 group. And I gave my first AA pitch 34 years ago. and have spoken on the average of twice a week since then. I didn't even stop speaking when I got drunk. You know, never confuse glibness with sincerity. But I have to be a fanatic. Now, maybe you don't. Maybe your drinking was kind of casual, easygoing. If so, you can have a casual, easygoing program. But I was a hardcore, drunken character, and I need a hardcore program. And that's why it would have done no good to have me on that sex and sobriety panel. Because I believe if you have a... If you really believe that you're turning your will and your life over, you don't have to explain to your higher power what your needs are in any field. They'll be taken care of. I literally believe that you could go to bed with a copy of the book, and if you stayed there long enough, someone would climb in with you. See, sex is a very important part of AA. We had the 13th step, as you know, long before we had the 12. The 12 steps had not been invented, not been written by Bill. When, as you've read in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, some of the ex-mayor of Akron and a new girl he was working with made out on Dr. Bob's operating table. You know, there's nothing new about this. You know, we tell every newcomer, do not become emotionally involved in the first year. Now, whether that's good advice, we have no idea, because no newcomer ever has taken it in the history of AA. As far as I'm concerned, get out there and get it on. If you're going to get drunk over getting laid, you weren't very hot for sobriety to begin with. I mean, that's no novelty. We tend to become emotionally involved with the people we sleep with. It's a natural condition. But you shouldn't take it personally. I remember a guy taking his inventory with me, you know, he was a Germanic character, and real free-flowing inventory. It began with the Roman numeral 1, subparagraph cap A, you know. And he was this kind of a guy, and he came into me one time and said, Don, you know, I can't stand it. You know this girl I went out with last week? I said, yeah, what about her? He said, she's going out with, he named some guy. And I said, oh. He said, you know him, he's the one guy in AA I hate. And she's going out with him just to spite me. And I said, no, she isn't. It's worse than that. You never entered her damn head. He asked her out, she went. What the hell did she think about you? He said, how can that be after all the things we said to each other that night? I said, well, you have to say something while you're taking off your clothes, otherwise the silence is horrible. As you know, as many of you have heard some of my tapes know, I came on the program and I met an absolutely lovely Latin girl who could not have children. God, she was a gorgeous girl. You know, and we got together and it turned out that despite the fact she couldn't have children, she had one. Now, I tell this story, or used to, in a way that was kind of an amalgam of the virgin birth and the immaculate conception. She used to tell it by just getting up and saying, I came on this program and one of your spiritual leaders knocked me up. But out of that, we had a little son that gave me the closest insight I've ever had to my higher power. Because I love this little kid, and I was like a grandfather. I was in my age at this point. Like my children, by the way, who saw me drinking, I quit relatively young, and they've all grown up, and not a one of them has had a problem. They're going to the right schools. They've all married right. They've produced 9 grandchildren. I keep waiting for one of them to fall on his ass so I can help him, and he won't do it. but this little kid came along, and I used to tell this story about how I was getting him ready one time to go out and play in the outdoors because he liked to play outside. But to take a child outside in the wintertime, you have to garb them properly. And I was putting him into a play suit. And I was putting his hands down through the sleeves and on his fingers. If you haven't done this recently, their fingers come up forming tentacles that stick in the webbing, you know. Put your goddamn thumb down, you know. I don't want to play outside. You want to play outside, kid? And I reasoned with him thus. And I finally get him dressed. I stand him out on the greensward. Is he humbly grateful for the good that I have brought to bear in his life? Not through his planning, not through his cooperation, but over his stout resistance. He was not. He was about 1 year old, and he would get out there, and he would just, if he could have snapped his fingers, he'd have done it. You know, about time things are beginning to break. He was taking credit. And I identified. All of my life, I have fought everything that was an improvement. Whenever I was being prepared for something, I resisted it, and I fought it. And this little child, I looked down at him, I thought, isn't that astonishing? An infant like that, he must have a power greater than himself or he would perish. Absolutely die. Little children, they don't know what is capable of eating, how to prepare it. They would die of starvation within a matter of days. They don't know how to protect themselves from the elements, how to put a roof over their head, garb themselves. They would die of exposure within a matter of hours, perhaps, in some conditions, without a power greater than themselves. They don't know what's dangerous in their little environment. They rush toward the stove, you know. They don't know they're being lovingly protected when you stop them. If they break free and touch it, then, oh, Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me? See, but this little child absolutely must have a power greater than himself or he cannot survive. And I was his greater power. I just loved this kid just this side of idolatry. And yet I couldn't communicate my adult mind to his infant mind to tell him what I had in store for him. Suppose there were a divinity. Suppose there were something that could mark the fall of the sparrow, could see within the holocaust of an atom, could watch the whirling nebulae in the sky. Could that something possibly communicate with me? Tell me what it's all about? Obviously not. And since that little time with that little kid, I have tried to relax and allow my fingers to slip through the sleeves of adversity when I seem to be in them. Because I came to believe right then, you know, that our Father, just like my little son's father, wants nothing but the best for us. And it's worked that way. After 15 wild and exciting years, that marriage ended. You know, and I thought no good can come of this but break my heart in two. I was left alone with that little kid. He was then just entering junior high school, I guess. Wildly crazy. I wish I could tell you, you know, that I communicated with him. Hell, of course I didn't communicate with him. A man who says he talks to his pubescent son lies about other things too. Adolescence is a form of insanity and they have no means of communication. They're dying the agonies of the damned and they can't express themselves. My boys, built like Greek gods, they get a pimple and their life is ruined. The girls, they'd come home, you know, in tears, and I'd say, what's wrong? That boy, what did he do? He looked at me. How did he look at you? Funny. What do you mean, funny? Aggressive, lewd, lured? What kind of hostile? Funny, funny, funny. Funny, funny. You know, they can't, no command of the English language. They go into their room and they turn up primordial grunts they've amplified and call music. Of course I didn't communicate with him. Hell, the only time I used to see him, I'd throw money in the hall. When he'd come out, ha! But it didn't bother me in that way. Because I had long since learned that the issue is not what kind of a child do I have, the issue is what kind of a parent am I. I did the same thing with my own father. He was a determined, gritty type, you know, never forgive anything by God. I'd been sober 20 years, and he thought, yeah, he seems like he's shaping up, but who can tell, you know. He would get so mad at me, he wouldn't even write to me if I didn't agree with him on something. I continued to write to him, because the issue isn't what kind of a parent do I have, the issue is what kind of a son am I. And when I was appointed to the appellate bench some years back, 10 or long years ago it is now, he got on a train up in Oregon and drove all the way down to Los Angeles. I don't mean he throws money away. He was a retired engineer. He had a pass. But he came all the way down in order that when we only sit once a month in the appellate courts, that when we walked in our black robes, he would be sitting there and seeing me. And I would see him, and that was the best he could do by saying, I accept you, I approve you. You know, I asked him, I was delighted to see him. I said, come on out the house to have dinner. He said, no thanks, I don't want to wear out my welcome. But the issue is, he wasn't loving me in the way I thought he should, but he was loving me in the only way he knew how. And I have gradually learned these things through these heartbreaks, through the son grew up. Now he's 25, I guess. He's turned agnostic. He doubts me. And I batched it for a few years, and then along came a young lady, a woman I spoke for. She was been sober 22 years now. I don't monkey with newcomers, but she was a secretary of a meeting, and I spoke there, and they say take away something from every meeting. I took the secretary. But she came on the program so astonishingly young that she's still like a child to me. I don't mean childlike. She's a very mature, bright woman. She went back to law school and passed the bar just so she could criticize my decisions. But she's young to me, and yet she seems to like me, and that's so good. And she doesn't object to old age creeping on her at night, and that's better. You know, and 30 years ago when I was trying to, 35 almost years ago now, when I was trying to find work back in my profession, law firms wouldn't even hire me with my background. They said, yeah, nice you're sober, but we couldn't send you into a courtroom to represent us because our people represent strength in the face of adversity, et cetera, et cetera. The guy who denounced me went off on a terrible tear just a few years after that, you know, took the secretary and a check protector and disgraced the firm, the family, Pasadena, the law, everything, cold sober. As I say, about 8 years ago, the governor of our state put me on the appellate bench. Now, you know what happens when members of that firm are in a courtroom and I come in? They stand up and they remain standing until I tell them they can be seated. And I haven't changed that much. I really haven't. I've learned to laugh at myself, which is the, if you don't learn to do, is going to cause you to miss the greatest joke in your own generation. I want you to know that. I'm sober, of course, which is the greatest change that can come into the life of an alcoholic, and I think AA. I even write it in my decisions sometimes. You know, I refiled one a while back, said principles obviously became hopelessly confused with personalities. The other day I said, in law as in life, half measures avail us nothing. And that's in your law library down here, by the way. You know, my colleagues say, where do you get those expressions? I don't know. They're building a new state building in Los Angeles, right in the middle of Skid Row, part of the redevelopment project. It's going up now. It's supposed to be completed the end of next year. If I'm still in office when that building is completed, I'll be able to take a wine bottle and throw it out my chamber's window and hit where I used to sell blood. How do you explain that? It's a miracle. Can't happen. How do you go from the pits, the lockups, the blackness? I sit on our highest court sometimes. Seven of us in our black robes. Six deadly serious, one giggling inwardly. And if I can get a little loft on that bottle, I'll be able to hit Clancy down at the Midnight Mission. And if that isn't enough to give you a desire to stay sober, I really don't know what it would take. Thank you.